Well, go ahead and grab your Bibles if you have them and turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's the book of Ecclesiastes, and we'll be in chapter 7 this morning. We have been slowly but surely making our way through this book together, and we come to the final section of what has been one of the longer but also one of the more complex chapters in all of Ecclesiastes. Solomon, who is our author here, as we've been seeing, is actually a man who is interested in wisdom. And so the entire book of Ecclesiastes is really just nothing more than one extended piece of divine wisdom. But as we've been seeing, it's of a much different kind of wisdom. It's much different than the typical sort of traditional wisdom like you might read about in the Proverbs. Rather, it speaks to those twisted things, to those sort of backwards things for which nothing seems to make sense. And so Solomon's just been observing that there are these aspects in life and really in this world that can be so incredibly difficult. Like there can be these experiences and circumstances that can be incredibly hard not only to interpret but also come to accept. Especially in a world that's been created and then sustained, as the scriptures say, by a good and ever-present creator. And so the wisdom that Solomon's been giving us is a kind of wisdom that's actually designed to help us navigate and really even just come to accept the reality of living in a broken, twisted world. But what's been interesting about chapter 7 is that for the first time in all of Ecclesiastes, that Solomon spent some time just giving us some traditional, more proverbial wisdom. And what's been interesting is that in the midst of that counsel, he was also careful to not let us forget that we still live in a fallen, sort of broken world. And so he just concluded in verse 14 by reminding us that this world is crooked, that it's actually twisted and fractured, and that reality isn't something that just happened by accident or somehow sits outside of God's control. And so not only did Solomon acknowledge that this world is bent and broken, but he was also quick to attribute this reality to the very hand and even purposes of God himself. And so if you remember, Solomon commanded us at the end of that section to actually consider this reality. That is to consider that when everything goes wrong and life just doesn't seem to make much sense. Like when you experience hardships, when you're just sort of feeling the weight of a trial press you, that the response of anyone who fears God and the response of anyone who longs to follow him is to be a kind of person committed to the reality of knowing that God causes all things, especially the difficult things, for your good and for your ultimate joy in him. And so he just said, when everything goes wrong and life seems so backwards and confusing, learn the discipline of pressing in. The discipline of acknowledging God and considering just what his purpose might be in bringing this affliction into your life. And so his point, when all was said and done, is that there are these lessons in the hard things. Lessons that refine, lessons which at the end of the day have this way of actually weaving together a kind of joy and vitality into your life. A kind of joy and vitality that sustains. And so as we move on now in chapter 7, we come to a rather difficult passage. And what I mean by difficult isn't so much that its message is hard to swallow or something like that, but rather that its structure is difficult to discern. And so just like the rest of chapter 7, this one's going to feel a little bit choppy because it seems like he's just sort of jumping from one topic to the next. But let me just say that while we do know that God inspired both the meaning and purpose of Scripture, we also know that he inspired the grammar and structure behind the Scriptures. And so since that's the case, I think that there's something for us here even this morning. So let's go ahead and read it and then we'll jump in. It's chapter 7 and we'll begin in verse 15 and go through the end of the chapter. Solomon writes, I have seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. So do not be excessively righteous, and do not be overly wise, for why should you ruin yourself? And do not be excessively wicked, and do not be a fool, for why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other, for the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. Also, do not take seriously all the words which are spoken, so that you will not hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. I tested all things with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious, so who can discover it? I directed my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. And I discovered more bitter than death the woman, whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Behold, I have discovered this, says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find an explanation, which I am still seeking, but have not found. I have found one man among a thousand, but I have not found a woman among all these. Behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but that they have sought out many devices. Well, before we get going, I just want to talk about an important term here in verse 15, and it's this term of futility. Now, I know that many of you are familiar with the term, but there are some newer people here who haven't been with us for Ecclesiastes, and so I just want to make certain that we're all on the same page with regard to understanding just some of the structures and themes with which Solomon is trying to write. And so this term futility, depending upon the context, is actually a term that has an incredible amount of meaning packed into it. And so the term is actually the Hebrew idea of what they call havel. That's the Hebrew word that's being used here. And so some translators will translate the term as vanity or futility, while others, like the NIV, might read something like meaningless. And part of that is just the result of how the translators understand not only the structure, but also the worldview from which the writer of Ecclesiastes is coming. And so depending upon where they land in terms of what they understand the writer be trying to do with the book, that actually determines how they choose to translate the term. But regardless, it is without a doubt the sort of controlling theme and idea behind the book, which is why it's so important to understand. So this term havel occurs about 65 times throughout the Hebrew Bible, which is just the Old Testament. And so a little over half of those occurrences, 38 to be exact, actually occur in these 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes. And so there really is no question that the term controls the structure and even the mind and the thought of Solomon. The term carries the idea of things like vanity, emptiness, nothingness, breath, vapor, void, fleeting, ephemeral, and can even be used as a synonym to describe things like idol or idolatry. And so while each one of those terms are right and appropriate to use depending upon the context, each one of those definitions sort of on their own just invariably falls short. And so one of the things that I've tried to do is just sort of stick with the Hebrew term havel, because depending upon the context, many of those definitions should come to your mind. Furthermore, the Hebrew idea of havel is also used throughout Ecclesiastes in a unique way. And that's just because it's used this way almost exclusively by Solomon. He also uses havel to describe the fact that we live in a world where sometimes things come about for which we don't have answers. Quite simply, the reality, as we've seen all throughout this book, is that there are unanswered but also unanswerable questions that will always exist. So, for example, as we saw in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, why is it that oftentimes the righteous are suppressed for their good deeds, but the unrighteous exalted? In other words, why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? And we'll talk a little bit about that today. Or in a world that was supposedly created and, as the Bible says, is now sustained by a good, all-loving creator, why is it that we see and experience so much evil, wickedness, and pain? And so the idea of Havel is actually used to speak of the fact that this world is broken, that it's actually fractured and twisted, that things are not what they ought to be. And so as Paul says in Romans chapter 8, all of creation has been subjected to a kind of futility from which it groans and actually longs to be redeemed. That every single part of creation, including you and me, experience a kind of twistedness and brokenness and futility that we know from the depths of our souls, this is not the way it's supposed to be. And so no matter the country, the generation, the system of government, and no matter the gender, race, or creed, the one thing they all have in common, regardless of degree, are things like injustice, oppression, and the overt exploitation of the weak. All you have to do is just read history. This is the nature of what it means to live in a Havel-ridden world, and you and I both know and feel that is backwards. And so the point of Solomon so far, as he's just been saying, is that none of us should actually be surprised by this. None of us should be surprised, because no matter what you put in place, or no matter what kinds of solutions that the wisdom of man thinks they may have found, the reality, as Solomon's been showing, is that there is no fixing. There is no straightening. There is no ultimate solution to the problem of Havel. Because as he states in chapter 1, there's actually nothing new under the sun. Everything's been tested. Everything's been tried. And so he just concludes this is simply a reality that we must come to accept. And so he's just been writing to give us some wisdom to help navigate in and through this reality. Furthermore, at a more personal level, the idea of Havel is also used to speak of the fact that nothing ever seems to satisfy the cravings of the human soul. That, like, no matter what you obtain or what you're able to achieve, you and I both know and constantly experience that the idea of something is always far better than what it actually produces once you get a hold of that thing. And so he just says over and over again that no matter if it's a relationship or a career or a house or maybe it's even just a reputation, once your hand actually grasps the thing that it's been longing for, the joy that it produces is like sand between your fingers. It is the experience of every human creature that there is no lasting contentment. There's no lasting satisfaction. Our experience day in and day out is that everything always fails and nothing ever seems to deliver as promised. And so Solomon, all throughout this book, just describes the activity of every man, woman, and child as nothing more than simply chasing after the wind. Where even if you knew where it was coming from or where it was going, his constant question is, what would you catch it with? We're on these pursuits. We're on these roads hoping and thinking and feeling that there's got to be something out there to satisfy the longings of our soul. But every time we think we found it, we found nothing. This is the nature of you and me, of every accomplishment, of every little trinket that sits on your shelf. All of those things, once you have them, leave you, if you're honest, feeling just as empty, just as anxious, and still longing to fill the void of what Solomon calls in chapter 3, the eternality that God has placed on your heart. And so he just says that that's the Havel. That's the twisted thing. That despite the fact that every single person's had eternity placed on their heart by an infinite creator, the reality is we still keep running, we still keep chasing, we still keep buying into the lie that some finite thing will actually satisfy the infinite gulf that sits at the center of your soul. And so Solomon, all throughout this book, has been labeling this activity of ours as Havel. That it's nothing more than an exercise of futility. And so Solomon spent most of his life trying to figure this out, which you can actually read about in chapter 2. And so for the rest of the book, he's decided to bring God into the picture and to get his perspective on some of these things. And so we find ourselves now in chapter 7 this morning and verse 15, where Solomon just makes yet one more observation about how this idea of Havel pervades everything. And here he's actually going to deal with the issue of trying to find some kind of virtue within people. In other words, trying to find the answers to the Havel either within people or even within yourself. So let's look at what he says here, starting in verse 15. He writes, "I have seen everything during my lifetime of Havel. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness." So he begins here by just saying, look, I have looked out and I have observed everything. Now, I have seen all things as king, and specifically I've seen those backwards things and those twisted things. And so upon observing all the brokenness and all the upside downness, here's one more thing I've seen. I've seen a righteous man, that is a good man, an upright man, work hard, deal justly, live honestly. And after all of his effort, after all of his sacrifice and hard labor, because he refused to lie, cheat, or steal, all he got for his reward was nothing. And in some cases, death. But beyond that, there are these wicked men. These wicked men who do nothing but cut corners and throw people under the bus and commit all kinds of evil acts out of the imagination of their wicked, sinful hearts. And all they ever seem to do is prosper more and more and more until eventually they're sitting at the top, filling their bellies on the backs of the righteous. It's backwards. Perhaps you see this today in the workplace, in government, even within ministries, which might call themselves a church. Solomon says there's just this reality in which those who seek to do good and live an honest life and try to deal justly with their fellow man just don't get very far. And in Solomon's day, that often meant death. So what's his response to this? Well, notice he doesn't actually give a solution. What I like about Solomon is that he's actually consistent within his own worldview. So he just framed this reality out in the context of Havel, which is, as we've seen, means there is no ultimate solution. And so if you think you found a solution and if you think you found a fix, it won't be long before you're disappointed. And so Solomon, being the wise man that he is, doesn't actually try to solve this problem, but just does what he's done with every other area of Havel, which is to give us some counsel and wisdom to navigate in and through the Havel. So look what he says about this in verses 16 and 17. He writes, "Do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise." Why? "For why should you ruin yourself? Also, do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool." Why is that? "For why should you die before your time?" Now, remember that Solomon's actually operating from a worldview that holds to traditional wisdom. That is, to a kind of wisdom which says that God ordered this universe in a certain way. And so generally speaking, if you do this, you'll be blessed. But if you do this, it'll go bad for you. And so Solomon's seeing that there are exceptions to that reality, namely this observation here in verse 15, he actually responds here by giving us some traditional wisdom. So what's his response? Well, coming off verse 15, where he sees the righteous perishing, his point here in commanding not to be excessively righteous or sort of overly wise is really just his way of saying and then warning us against putting all of our hope in wisdom to protect us from the pain and the hardships of life. And the reason for that is because not only can you not achieve perfect wisdom, as he's going to go on to say in verse 20, but the greater reality is that no matter how righteous or godly a person might be, the truth of the matter is they still live in a broken, sinful world. The reality is that sometimes those who live a life according to what God delights in can still experience often the kind of reality that's deserved only of the fool. And so all that Solomon's saying here is that to try and pursue righteousness with the goal of thinking that God will then somehow inoculate you from the brokenness of a fallen world could very well just end up driving you into madness, which is what he means here by this term ruin, since sometimes God still allows the righteous to suffer. Just read the book of Job. In the midst of his obedience, wisdom still couldn't help him. And so just in thinking about this from a little different perspective, I do wonder how many of us, if we're honest, still tend to beat ourselves up and think that our sufferings and hardships or the bad things that might come to us are nothing less than our failings before an angry God. And so what we'll do is we'll actually begin to think that God is somehow punishing us because we haven't yet achieved sinless perfection. And so we just end up interpreting the hard things in the struggles of life then as the heavy hand of a divine taskmaster just trying to beat out the sin. That surely there must be something I'm doing or decisions I'm making that are so incredibly displeasing to God. Now, it might be the case. And without trying to diminish the fact that God does discipline those whom he loves and does reprove his wayward sons and daughters, according to Hebrews chapter 12, the point of Solomon here is simply to say, what if the reality of your hardships and your sufferings, especially in the midst of trying to live a life of obedience, is simply the reality of living in a broken, fallen, havel-ridden world? What if the fact that you have an incredibly difficult situation at home, or the lazy coworker just keeps getting raises before you, or just in general, nothing in life which you desire, even though it might be a good desire, ever seems to work out, doesn't at all have anything to do with God's discipline of you, but is simply the result of an existence crippled by havel? The observation of Solomon here is simply to say, don't necessarily view these things as wrath, brokenness. That as he's been saying all throughout this book, there's just a backwardness. There's just something bent and twisted to a life lived under the sun. And so the call of this verse, when all is said and done, is simply, so don't be surprised by this. Don't be surprised when you see wicked people prospering and righteous people suffering. And furthermore, don't think that the answer and solution to this problem is just a little bit more wisdom. Don't think that if you can just posture yourself in a certain way or maybe learn how to navigate perfectly enough that somehow God will bless you more, that you figured out some secret to life. But on the other hand, as he says here, just don't go the opposite way either. Don't just think that because you see wicked people prospering, that if you decide to start pursuing folly, that things will then just somehow work out for you. And the reason for that is because, as Solomon well knows, traditional wisdom still holds true. That generally speaking, fools will suffer the fate of their own folly. And so Solomon's just saying here, look, don't be surprised at the twistedness. But on the other hand, don't think that there's some way to escape it. Neither the pursuit of more wisdom or, on the other hand, diving into much folly will ever solve the problems of havel. And so as he says here in verse 18, it's the wise person, that is the one who fears God, who can recognize and actually become comfortable with the fact that there's just a kind of balance to life. A kind of balance in which you hang on to both of these truths. That wisdom won't solve the reality of havel, but neither will folly numb you to the hardships of havel. And so for Solomon, the best way to approach this kind of reality is simply to approach it with the fear of God. For as he goes on to say in chapter 12, that kind of approach is not only the key to joy in the midst of havel, but it's actually the ultimate answer to everything. Next, verse 19. He writes, wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Now, with this one, Solomon's just giving a general statement on the value of wisdom. And so while he just got done saying that wisdom can't actually solve the problems of Havel, he's still going to say here that the exercise of wisdom is always better than the strategies and the opinions of the so-called experts, which is what he means here by the rulers of a city. And the reason that it's better is because, notice, he says that wisdom actually has this way of strengthening a person. It has this way of actually causing them to live a kind of life where they're no longer tossed around or become victim to every new opinion of man. Furthermore, the wise person, sort of in their wisdom, actually possesses the ability to block out the voices of the age. An age in which so many feel the pressure and even the guilt to live in a manner that pleases the thoughts and opinions and the motivations of this world. And so what I love about this proverb, especially in light of its connection to verse 20, is that true wisdom, that is God's wisdom, is always just better. That's the point. And the reason that it's better is because no matter how good or attractive or even helpful that a person's words might be in the moment, as he states in verse 20, the reality is that there is no person who continually does good or is without sin. And now remember that in the context of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is actually writing to his son who would be king. And so Solomon, knowing in the fullness of measure what it's like to be constantly surrounded by people who want your ear and who want to offer you their advice and maybe tell you what they think you should do and tell you how they think you should deal with the problem, he's just going to say to his son, look, learn to recognize the wisdom and then block out the voices. Even the so-called experts, and those who have experience, even those who are in positions of influence or places of power, at some point in your life, you're going to have to decide who or what you're going to let speak into it. And so what he means here in verse 20 is that no matter who you surround yourself with, and so no matter what their stated intentions, the reality is that there is no person or opinion that's always for your good or for your ultimate success. What it means to live in a broken, fractured world is there's always going to be agendas. There's always going to be schemes, either big or small. And as he states here, especially from those who are perhaps closest to you and sit in places of power. And so since that's the reality and since that's the nature of living in a broken world, he essentially goes on to say once again in verse 21, so don't be surprised by this. Don't take seriously or give much weight to what people say, especially because you know that what people will say with the utmost of reverence in the throne room is often far different from what they murmur over in the servant quarters. People are always fronting. They're always posturing. They're always doing what they can do to push their agenda. And so when you don't follow those words or you don't do what they think you should do, people are so incredibly prone to just rip you apart. This happens from the closest and most trusted to those who speak in your life, those who profess to be looking out for your best interest. This happens from the closest of friends and family all the way down to the lowest on the pole. And so Solomon's just saying this is the nature of what it means to be in leadership in places of power, but also just the nature of what it means to live a life in a broken, fractured world. The reality is we've all been hurt. We've all been backstabbed. We've all experienced to whatever degree the reality of what it means to be betrayed. But I like what he says here in verse 22. Notice what he says. While we've all to whatever degree experienced this kind of reality, he states, don't take seriously everything you might hear about you. Why? Because the truth of the matter and the reality of your life and mine is that you and I have both done the exact same thing. Cursing, backstabbing, grumbling, complaining, murmuring, all of those things are a reality of this world, and not merely because they're things that have happened to you, but in the first instance, because they're things that you yourself have done. And so all that Solomon is saying here is that people are just people. They're always going to complain. They're always going to mumble and always going to tell you what they think you should do and then trash you when you don't follow it. But the point of Solomon here within context is essentially, so what? Get a conviction about something. Don't just change your mind because someone decided to complain or that you made an error because someone thinks you should have done it a different way. The reality is that there's always going to be people who think that the right way and the only way is their way. And so Solomon's just here to say to his son, so let him talk. It's literally all they have. But the greater point of Solomon here is actually found in verse 19. And his point is that when it comes to leadership, or having to make an important decision, or really just when it comes to life in general, regardless of the situation or circumstance, the greatest voice you could ever have speaking into your ear and informing your mind and your heart are not the voices of the experts or those who even claim to have your best interest, but rather it's always and it's only wisdom. And not just what sounds good and sounds like wisdom, but within the context of Ecclesiastes, it's a kind of wisdom which actually comes from God. It's wisdom that's true. It's wisdom that's everlasting. In other words, for our purposes, it's simply the unchanging word of God. It's the scriptures. Just in thinking about this in light of some conversations I've had, I just kept thinking, and it's actually something I think often, but I just kept thinking that at some point, as professing believers, that is, as those who say that they know and believe the Word of God to be the wisdom of God, and who might even be able to say with Peter that the Scriptures are indeed sufficient for all things pertaining to both life and godliness, all of us eventually at some point are going to have to decide if that reality is what we actually believe or if that's just something that we say we believe. Because the reality is that at some point, either you're trusting the Scriptures to be the unchanging, everlasting, forever settled in heaven word sufficient for your issue, or you're simply placating your conscience and living in a consistent state of enormous hypocrisy. And the only reason I say that is because the stuff that keeps so many of us up at night, that is the anxiety and the stress and the depression, or maybe just the fear of the unknown, all of those things at some point are no longer just the initial reaction to your difficult circumstance, but are actually the ongoing evidence of what you're actually believing or not believing. It's the evidence of the wisdom in which you're actually trusting and hoping, which, if we're honest, is oftentimes our own voices. Or as he's going to go on to say here in a moment, the idolatry of our own wicked hearts. And so Solomon just says, it's the wise person who can learn to recognize the falsehood, shut out the noise, and instead begin to orient themselves around the wisdom of God. For as he says, it's true wisdom. In other words, it's the Scriptures that'll actually sustain. It's the kind of stuff that while there is no true fixing of the Havel, which is what all the voices of the age claim to be able to do constantly, the Scriptures are the one thing that'll sustain, or as he says here in verse 19, actually strengthen you in and through the Havel. I think that what all Christians eventually have to come to grips with at some point in their walk is the reality that nowhere in the Scriptures does God ever actually promise to fix your situation. He just doesn't. But what he does do is promise over and over again that he'll sustain you in and through the situation. And so the only question for us is, do we believe this? Do we actually trust his word to be sufficient and sustain us? Tough question. Next, verses 23 through 26. He writes, I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious, so who can discover it? I directed my mind to know and investigate and seek wisdom and an explanation and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. So he just says here, look, I have exhausted myself. And I have, with all of my heart and mind and soul and strength, put every effort of who I am into becoming wise. I wanted to know the nature of this world, the nature of why things are the way that they are. I wanted to find a solution to the madness and the folly that is this life. But after all of my searching and all of my investigations, my only conclusion when all is said and done is there is no finding it. There is no ultimate solution among men to, as he says here, the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. For what has been remote and still exceedingly mysterious. And so he just says here, the further I dig and the further I investigate to come up with some kind of answer to this broken world, the further I actually feel lost and without an answer. But look what he does here in verse 26. He makes this seemingly random statement. He states, well, I came up feeling more lost and perhaps empty than when I started. There is one thing that after all of my investigations that I did discover. Verse 26. And I discovered more bitter than death. Strong words. The woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner or fool will be captured by her. Now, if you've been here with us for all of Ecclesiastes, verses 23 through 26 should actually sound a little bit familiar. And that's just because he's actually picking up on the language and ideas from chapters 1 and 2. If you remember, at the end of chapter 1, Solomon, seeing that this world was fractured by Havel, he said that he set his mind and all of his wisdom and resources to try and find some kind of solution. You remember that? In fact, it was actually his attempt to try and find some kind of meaning and purpose to his existence. And so starting in chapter 2, he pursued anything and everything with all of his might and wealth and power beyond, frankly, anything that you or I could ever imagine. And so he pursued things like building projects and throwing parties which lasted for weeks, for which he had to slaughter literally hills of cattle to feed his guests. You remember that he built a house which took him 183,300 men and 13 years to build. He even amused himself and actually tried to numb himself with some of the finest food and entertainment on the planet. And so he pursued drunkenness and hobbies and power. And after all of his experimenting and indulging, his only conclusion when all was said and done was vanity of vanities, all is vanity. These things satisfied for a season, but ultimately failed. And so he discovered that at the end of the day, there was actually nothing. That there was no finite thing on this earth that could ultimately satisfy his heart. And so in all of that experimenting, you'll remember one of the things that he experimented with to try and fill the void was women. And so in 1 Kings chapter 11, the writer tells us that Solomon actually had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He was a man who, as it says in verse 1 of that chapter, loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, including Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonites, and Hittite women from the nations. And so without trying to get too graphic here, he had literally every size, shape, color, and demographic on the planet. And so he certainly wasn't a man who lacked desire, but he certainly didn't lack opportunity. And so knowing that all things had failed, that all pursuits and projects and entertainment had failed, his next thought was that maybe this thing called intimacy would do it. That maybe just feeling close to somebody, or that he was actually wanted and loved, would somehow fill the gap of eternity on his heart. And so after that final pursuit and final experiment, we read of his conclusion here in verse 26 of chapter 7. He states, "More bitter than death is the woman." Well, what kind of woman? "The woman whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are chains." Now, it is important for me to say that Ecclesiastes is actually a book that's deeply rooted in the creation account of Genesis. And so Solomon isn't actually speaking ill of women here in general, nor is he speaking sort of demeaningly of marriage. But what is clear from the language and the terms that he uses here is that he has a certain kind of woman in mind. And it is without a doubt the kind of woman, as one commentator labels here, as the hunter. You'll notice the language of snares and nets and chains. Now, it's important to keep in mind that Ecclesiastes is simply being written from a male perspective. And so to think that these words are a statement only true of women actually misses the point. The point of the verses and the meaning of Solomon here is actually to make a statement on just the absolute folly of trying to discover some kind of meaning or satisfaction in relationships, whether it be from the male or female perspective. And so what Solomon's saying is that there's just a kind of lie we can buy into, but actually a kind of trap we can fall into when we start looking to things like people and relationships as the answer to havel, to the loneliness or perhaps emptiness or search for purpose and contentment that we often may feel even in our own hearts. I think all of us could recount perhaps dozens of examples where we've seen people run to a relationship or even maybe refuse to get out of a relationship simply because they think this person is the one. That this person is the answer that'll finally satisfy the longing and somehow fill the craving in their heart. Even married people. How many think that if my spouse were just a little more spontaneous or would just show a little bit more affection, then all that ails me and all that seems to be lacking would finally be full? Solomon's just here to say, been there, done that. In fact, not only did he have every kind of relationship you could imagine, but he also experienced the fullness and even the depths of what the most intimate of relationships could offer. Just read about that in Song of Solomon. Remember, Solomon pursued his experiments, as he states in chapter 1, with a mind to know wisdom, to know the way in which God designed things to be. And so he wasn't merely interested in satisfying the sort of momentary or superficial senses, but actually the deep places. He wanted to find and actually come to know a lasting contentment at the deepest of levels. And so after all of his effort and all of his wives and all of his concubines, he just says, when all is said and done, I've been there, done that in ways and capacities beyond what most will ever know or even hope to experience. And my only conclusion in the final analysis of the thing is don't fall into the trap. Don't fall into the trap called passion. It is a good thing. It is a gift of God, but like everything else, it's also a gift that's been subjected to futility. And so the reality is that since your heart and your desires are truly eternal, whether you choose to acknowledge that or not, there's nothing on this earth, especially in another finite person or relationship, that'll actually satisfy the infinite longings in your heart. And so he just says in verse 26, the reality is that if you keep pursuing relationships and keep pursuing people and passion long enough, eventually a day is coming in which the only thing you'll come to know is bitterness. A kind of bitterness, as he says, that's worse than even death. And so he just says, pursue the things which are pleasing to God. Don't be like the fool who gets caught and controlled and is led around by their passions. For as the picture of being caught in a trap here implies, sometimes God is actually quite pleased to allow the fool to suffer the fate and pain of their folly. And so Solomon, in all of his God-given wisdom, says, so be wise. Be wise. That is, set your heart and your mind to pursue that which is pleasing to God. For the reward and the joy and the contentment is far greater and in the grand scheme of eternity, far more infinite than any finite person has the ability to ever offer. And so he just says, be wise, be the kind of person who guards their heart. Finally, verses 27 through 29. And here we'll actually see how what we just saw sort of serves as a kind of illustration of actually a much greater point. He writes, behold, I have discovered this, says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find an explanation which I am still seeking but have not found. I have found one man among a thousand, but I have not found a woman among all these. So here he just kind of continues the theme of the passage. And is still just stating how there's very little virtue or solution to the problem of Havel to be found within people. And so his statement here about there being no virtue or wisdom among women and only one among men isn't a statement that men are somehow better than women or something like that. But rather, when you keep it together, it's actually a commentary or rather indictment on the whole of humanity in general. Because one man among a thousand still isn't a very good statistic. And so it's just a universal statement about humanity. Notice also how he states the point. He says, starting in verse 27, I've added one thing to another to find an explanation which I'm still seeking but have not found. In other words, this is just his way of saying it isn't the final answer. He's still searching. He's still investigating and thinking that there might be a little more to discover. But regardless, it's still a pretty pessimistic statement. In other words, he's not willing to conclude that there's no virtue among humanity, but he is concluding that there's no ultimate solution to the problem of Havel to be found within humanity. That's his point. And notice why. Verse 29. Why is there no ultimate solution or straightening out of the bent things to be found within people? Behold, I have found only this, that God has made men upright, but that they have sought out many devices. If you want to know the reason for why, at the end of the day, all that's in this world seems to be so bent and broken and twisted and fractured, and why nothing ever seems to work out, or why you experience so much pain and frustration and vexation, it's because at the deepest levels of the human desire, of that which controls all that we think and feel and love and long for, the reality, whether we like to admit it or not, is that you and I have nothing less than a sinful, wicked, pleasure-seeking heart that while it professes to be wise by claiming it knows the answer, that it knows what'll make you happy, that it knows what'll bring lasting contentment and fill the void, the reality is that it only knows folly because instead of pursuing the eternal Creator himself, it longs to be satisfied in idols. Our hearts are, as John Calvin once stated, a veritable factory of idols. for the first time in all of Ecclesiastes, Solomon actually turns the corner from that which is external to man to that which is actually internal. To the place where the fullest and the truest expression of the problem of Havel lies. As we've been seeing, Havel is more than just sin. There is an external element to the brokenness and fallenness of this world. But at the very center of God's creation sits man. And at the very center of every man, woman, and child sits a broken, fractured heart. A heart that by its very nature, as Paul states in Romans, does not love God, does not seek God, does not long for the things that honor his name, but instead and only loves self. According to Solomon, the reason that we're constantly groping for a bigger house, for a better paying job, for a nicer car, to use his illustration, freedom from loneliness by pursuing some kind of relationship, isn't actually because those things in reality will actually solve the problem of your discontentment. But from the idolatry and the sinfulness of our own hearts, we've set those things up as ultimate because we bought into the lie that they will satisfy and that they will fill a heart that's had eternity placed on it by an eternal creator. That's the problem. For Solomon, the problem of Havel isn't merely something that sits outside of a person, but in the first place is something deep inside of a person. Quite simply, the issue of Havel is ultimately within broken humanity. And so Solomon, in all of his searching, in all of his pursuits, in all of his investigations, discovered this reality to be true. At the end of the day, when it comes to humanity, Solomon learned that despite the fact that God did make man upright, the reality, whether we choose to acknowledge it or ignore it, is that we've simply pursued our own devices, or literally here, pursued the inventions out of the wickedness of our own imaginations. Which, by the way, all throughout the scriptures, apart from the reality of God's wrath, is one of the most frightening concepts. So what's the point? How do we bring this all together? Well, in verse 19, Solomon said that it's wisdom which actually strengthens a man, which of course begs the question, strengthens him from what? Well, in the context of the passage, the answer is obviously folly in the midst of Havel, and specifically folly in the form of an idolatrous heart. And so for the answer for Solomon, when all is said and done to this problem called Havel, is wisdom. And not because Solomon's wisdom actually solves the problems of Havel, but because it functions to help us navigate in and through the Havel. But here's what's important to know within the larger context of the scriptures. Solomon was writing in a time in history that was pre-Christ. That is, he didn't actually have the full picture of why the world is the way it is. Nor did he have an understanding of how or in what way it could actually be solved. He just knew from his own experience that it was so incredibly screwed up, but that in the midst of that twistedness, he was still going to have to give an account to his creator. He was still going to have to stand before the judge, knowing, as he states in chapter 12, that God will bring every act to judgment, everything. Whether it's hidden, whether it's good or evil. And so what I love about the scriptures, just in sort of the way that they're laid out for us, is as you begin to read through the Old Testament, there's just this constant theme of anticipation. There's this constant theme of hope and longing and looking for all things to be set right. And so the writers of the Old Testament had no idea what that would look like or even how God would do it, but they just knew that he would. They knew him to be faithful to his promises. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, which is in the New Testament, That is, it's after Christ came and lived and died and rose again and ascended back to his Father. Paul is writing to a people in the midst of an incredibly confused church, but also just in the midst of an incredibly confused culture. A culture that was obsessed in looking for answers through signs and wisdom. Honestly, not all that different than Solomon. And so Paul shows up in the form of this letter and actually begins to speak truth. And so in chapter one, he actually challenges those who are beginning to wander away from what he calls here the wisdom of God with these words. He states, where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for sign and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To Jews, a stumbling block, and to the Gentiles, folly. But to those who are called, that is, those who are being saved, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is both the power of God and the very wisdom of God. If you're here this morning and you're not a believer, my words to you right now are simply this. The scriptures declare that you are broken. That you're a person, as Solomon states, who can do nothing more with your life than perpetually chase the wind. The reality is that you're spending your days constantly running and constantly chasing after anything and everything to try and fill the void, to try and fill the eternality that's been placed on your heart. And so you're seeking for meaning and purpose and satisfaction in things like your job and your skills or even people or relationships. But the problem, and you know this from the depths of your own experience, you don't need Solomon to tell you this, that nothing ever satisfies, does it? Nothing ever seems to work out. Nothing ever seems to fill that which seems to be forever lacking. And so the message of the scriptures to you this morning is this. It's simply the message to stop running. Stop chasing. Stop buying into the lie that something out there is going to solve the insolvable problems of this world and the insolvable problems of your life. And instead, as God pleads with you, that through what seems to be such a foolish sounding message to a broken, dying world is simply to trust the words and the promise of this passage that God has already solved the Havel for you and he's done it in the form of the crucified Christ. What's so glorious about the gospel message, that is the message that Christ died and rose, is that in that reality, God promised and secured not only to forgive you of your sin, not only to set this world straight, not only to deal with all that's gone wrong, but what's more glorious than any of those realities is that in the forgiving work of the cross, you get eternity. And it's in eternity where you get the eternal God himself. The only reality that's infinite, and then can therefore fill the eternality that's been placed on your heart. And so the scriptures say you can keep chasing. You can keep running. You can keep groping for that which is unattainable, but it's simply an exercise of futility because the truth of the matter is you've simply been created for something eternal. And for those of you who do believe this, for those of you who do love the message of the gospel, the message that in Christ you experience joy and satisfaction and you get eternal contentment because you get the eternal God himself, the greatest of all realities, but you perhaps find yourself once again growing cold. Maybe you find yourself in a place where you once were, in a place where you experienced things like anxiety, depression, and stress. My encouragement to you this morning is to pay careful attention to the words of Solomon. Do a legitimate analysis of your life for where you perhaps even allowed passively an idol to be erected. Do an examination. Where do you spend your thoughts? What are the things that have been driving you? What are those areas in your life that have been capturing your affections? What are the things or the thing that's caused you to start feeling a little too much like this is actually home when you know it's not? So here's my final word to us this morning. There is very good reason for when Jesus showed up, why he could actually say that something greater than Solomon is here. It is in the person of Christ that all the pain and all the suffering and all the sorrow and all the longings of this world would be dealt with in full. And so the call of this passage and the message of the gospel is that you would come to Christ, that you would rest in him and be forever and fully content. For as Christ himself stated, if anyone is thirsty, that is longing, aching, feeling the groans of a world subjected to havel, let him come to me and drink. And he who believes in me, as the scripture said, from his innermost being will flow rivers of living water. And so that's the promise, and that's the joy.